Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
Hi, hi, you spooky little babies. Sarah here. I know we normally need to get right into it, but I just wanted to flag up that this is the very last episode of the current series of The Fear. Oh, I know. It's been lush. It's been fabulous. It's been swell. But the swelling's gone down now. And I'm going to take a little break, record some new episodes, and come back to you soonish. Let's keep it vague. Sometime in the new year, I'd imagine. But what a fabulous episode to end on. Vicky Pepperdine. I love her. She's amazing. You know her from Getting On and Camping and all of the comedy shows that you love. And she's also the co-creator of the podcast Dear Joan and Jerrica. If you haven't listened to that already, oh, you're in for a world of gorgeousness. It's so funny and disgusting and filthy, and it's Vicky and Julia Davis as agony aunts answering people's letters. And oh my god, it's like Derek and Clive meets Savage Love meets just two women being appalling in a kitchen, and I love it very much. We recorded this interview back in the summer, so it was before the second series came out. If you're looking for other podcasts to listen to while you're on a break, you could go through the back catalogues of The Fear. There's like four series to listen to. Or check out some of the other fine shows on the Great Big Owl Network. There's loads. But for now, thanks so much for listening. I really enjoyed doing these. I love talking to people who I think are funny and brilliant about what they're scared of. It's been very cathartic. It's been daft. It's been, you know, even in the bits where I have to edit it and I go, God, I hate my own voice. And then go, oh, God, you hate your own voice. What an interesting observation that is, Sarah. Even then, I still really love making these. So if you've enjoyed them, review it somewhere. Anyway, have a fabulous regular Christmas, and try not to be dicks to each other, and I'll see you soon for the next series of The Fear. But for now, the Queen, Vicky Pepperdine. Thank you, and bye-bye. Hello and welcome to The Fear, a podcast about the overlap between comedy and horror. My name's Sarah Morgan. Hello. My guest this episode is writer and actor Vicky Pepperdine.
Hello, hello.
Hello. How are you, Vicky?
I'm very well. Thank you for inviting me on.
Thank you.
Pleased to be here.
Oh, so you were telling me that you're in the middle of writing something.
I am, yes.
So I'm very sorry for distracting you.
That's absolutely fine. No, it's good to leave the house, actually, is the truth.
Is that your process?
It kind of is, yeah. I mean, actually, I go away sometimes. I go on sort of, if I can afford to, I go to stay in secluded places, and that is marvellous.
That's the dream.
Totally recommend that if anyone can and wants to. But yeah, so that's the sort of, that helps, because I've got lots of things at home that distract me, including dogs and very grown up children.
Very grown up children.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
interesting. Yeah, yeah. So writing at home is an absolute nightmare because there's so many distractions, and yet I'm not one of those, like, I'm going to fold my sock drawer or anything like that.
No,
the distractions
no,
are
no I don't wash up, there's nothing like that. No it's just more things like, I don't know, it's just hard to get my head into focus when I know that someone might arrive home, or a lovely dog might bark to get some attention or help, in inverted commas. You know, it's just that sort of thing, or someone at the door with a you know, an Amazon parcel that you didn't know was coming.
Sure, exactly. Well, that can take an hour at
that
least.
Really
yeah.
Can.
Oh God,
yeah.
Well, you've broken my train of thought. Oh no.
Exactly.
Yeah, tell me about your writing process.
Well, it's
and what are you working on?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. Well, I mean, I'm working on two things at the moment. One is for a. Yeah, I don't know how much I'm allowed to say, but I'm going to say it, and then
sure.
you can edit it out.
Yeah, yeah, tell me data.
Feel like
if
it.
Yeah.
So two things. One is a radio pilot for TV, which is this thing that they do at the BBC sometimes where you record a pilot for a show that goes out on Radio 2, and then the hope is that it then goes on to be a TV show.
Ah, I've heard of this, yes.
So that's something I've been working on in the last year, actually.
Wow.
Called Always June, about a difficult landlady and her difficult tenants. And then the other thing I'm working on is a show about a community, a group of people living in community, which is essentially a very patriarchal community. And it's how they manage that life.
Interesting. Yeah. And are you writing these on your own?
I've been developing Always June with Morgana Robinson.
Oh, fantastic.
And then I'm developing the Brotherhood of the Deplorable Tongues. Working title.
No,
although
won't.
I love it.
Yeah.
With Sian Gibson and Rosie Cavallero, although I'm writing that one on my own. So a lot of sitting in rooms and working on laptops and getting very, very stiff neck from the process.
Mm.
Yeah. So what I love to do is do improv and kind of playing around with people and then going off and kind of basically structuring, distilling, honing endlessly and and then trying to sort of make it more like my favorite TV shows if I possibly
that's really
can.
Interesting I've always wanted to ask you like who your role models are, who do you have sort of
I began with people like French and Saunders and Victoria Wood and Wood and Walters and that kind of genius world and then I kind of, as everyone has really, got into a lot of the American TV brilliance. I mean, I always loved Friends, actually, just to say, but I sort of now more recently in recent years have discovered things like, as everyone has, Better Things and Big Little Lies and all those brilliant shows that are now coming out that we're getting from America. And that sort of crossover that I think hope is happening a little bit where we're all going, oh, I like that, and influencing each other potentially across the oceans.
It's so much easier to have kind of voices in your head that you are influenced by that are sort of paving the way through the rainforest. You don't pave through rainforest.
You do. You're doing that, but that's bad for the planet.
That really is. Yeah. I'm thinking that's not you at all.
You're growing palm oil and you're basically
killing orangutans for the sake of art. Yeah.
You bastard.
Macheteing through the rainforest is what I meant. Just people who
or knocking it aside with sticks and it stays intact. You know, just gentle stick knocking. But yes, absolutely. Yeah. Kind of taking on other. I don't know, it's not exactly other voices, but it's sort of what do I love, why do I love it, and what in me is the equivalent that I can try and put into what my work is, if you see what I mean.
Absolutely. Well, it's interesting as well that the people you've listed are all pretty much all female-led.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
that's
totally.
Amazing because I think they try and present it like there's a very much a one-in, one-out policy with things with women in.
Oh, yes.
And it's become our job for some reason to go, no, that's not true.
Yeah.
There's 6 seats there,
exactly.
And one of them's got girl chair written on it, but that doesn't mean that's true. All those seats are ours. Stop trying to make us sort of compete with each other.
Completely.
And because actually it terrifies them when we work together.
I know. It's really interesting, isn't it? I think it's something that I really, really hope is changing now. Mm. And I hear that at Edinburgh, which I'm unfortunate I can't get to this year, there are just amazing young women and older women doing amazing work. So that's exciting.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's 30% this year, doesn't sound like load, but it's actually the highest they've ever had. 30% of performers are female.
That's amazing. That's good.
Well, it means things are changing. And also, I think the big shift has been, I think a lot of shows in the last couple of years have been men and women trying to process the Me Too movement and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And how men sort of going, how can I be a better feminist? And women going, like, here's all the terrible things that happened to me.
I
think this year, the shift with the shows has been that the men are still doing good work and talking about how to, you know, how to process this stuff from their point of view. And the women have just gone, well, we've done that now, bye. And they're all doing like really silly, funny stuff and just really enjoying themselves.
Yeah,
so that seems to be
And that's really good, because I think the other thing that's been I've been very conscious of throughout my sort of working life is the confidence. I hate the word confidence, actually, because I think it's sort of slightly meaningless word. But what I mean is the kind of... well, maybe it's bravery, maybe it's fear of women actually putting their work out there, and how much harder it is, I believe, or has been harder for women to have the courage to put their voices out there without being fearful of being, you know, being told that they're not good enough.
Yeah.
And that sort of validation that boys get from, or have got historically over the, you know, the from very, very early years of being in kindergarten of kind of, yes, Billy, you're great. And, oh, that's a pretty dress. Jane, of that kind of, you know, difficulty of where is my voice? What is my voice? What have I got to say that's interesting? And how do I do it? Is something that I hope and believe is more emergent with young women nowadays.
Absolutely. Well, I would, you know, I think as well, talking about the you know, there being the girl chair, and if you have one girl in a room, that's never, no, they're never going to have, they're going to be in charge of all women all the time, so, and
absolutely,
everything.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then what happens if you get two women in a room and they talk to each other, you end up sort of unleashing this repressed box there's sort of all these things that we've not been talking about, and we think no one will be interested in us
That's talking about it.
It's our experience and it's not the experience of the other people in the room.
Yeah.
And then you end up with the nightmare fuel that is Joan and Jerrica. When you get two women in a room who have none of those boundaries, who have none of those. I'm such a massive fan, as you know. I've worked with Vicky before, and we were on a, like a family Radio 4 show, like really nice, really family, really good, really well-intentioned, and there were kids, and all I wanted to do was lean over to Vicky every time, because it was just like whisper Joan and Jerrica things to
like scene quotes,
like a super fan just going like clitoral gingivitis. just I couldn't. And it was so, but you so can we talk about Joan and Jerrica? How did that come about?
Well, basically that is a show that came about from Julia Davis and me sitting in her kitchen and doing some improvisation. So we didn't know what it was going to be. We just had these characters in our heads. And I think Julia wrote a problem as our first foray, and we started to answer it. And then I think we gradually thought, I think this might be something that's a goer. But really, we did it for fun, and we did it completely without any intention of broadcast, really, actually. Yeah. It was sort of just generating material initially. And then, you know, somewhere down the line, maybe after a good few months, Julia said, why don't we put this into a podcast? And I said, I don't know what podcasts are, really, because they were sort of, I don't know, they were sort of on the edge of certainly my generation's sort of radar, I think, that they were sort of, we knew they happened, but we weren't really listening to them. And I think that in the last couple of years, that's massively, massively changed.
Yeah. So that a friend too many bloody podcasts, I'd say.
Well, yes, I mean, which ones can we cut? Let's do a cull. But no, not at all. But anyway, don't go there. Don't go there. But, you know, a friend of mine from university emailed me and said, oh, my God, my daughter's just recommended, my 20-year-old daughter has recommended a podcast to me, and it's Dear Joan and Jerrica. And she's so thrilled that I know you, so I just thought I'd get in touch. So that, to me, is just joyous, because I sort of feel like if young women like what old women have to say, that's super cool.
I think it's so, oh, God, the... So it's the two of you sitting in Julia's kitchen, and I love that it didn't come from like, let's try and come up with a, what's selling nowadays, things with women in, let's do a you made each other laugh.
We just made each other laugh, essentially.
Astonishing.
Yeah.
And it's, your two agony aunts. And what's brilliant about it is the characters are just, they've got such a clear worldview, which is the opposite of all the sort of, oh, God, the sort of, like, careful feminist women helping women, all the kind of stuff that we're all so careful about all the time at the moment, and you're just horrible.
Yeah, I mean, we are horrible.
How much fun is it?
It is fun. I won't lie. It is fun. It's fun, and I think because you do it somewhere private, it becomes much easier. There's no sense of I must be good, I must try really hard. You just sort of do it. And then you can edit it if you want to.
Yeah,
of course,
how much
you know,
editing is involved?
Well, quite a lot of are taken out. You can probably hear from me, unless Sarah's kindly taken
I'll
out.
I'll probably take out some ums.
Some ums, some ahs. bits of editing, but essentially just a big old improvisational love fest from our point of view.
Oh, God. And you, so how often do you make each other break? Because that's my favourite thing in it, is when I can feel a giggle being held back. Yeah,
it kind of varies, really. It sort of depends what the content is and the audacity-ometer of what somebody's saying, you know. And I think we just try and let go of any sense of reservations or is that a bridge too far, which is a bit dangerous, to be honest, because you do think I could really offend people. But actually, we don't really talk about it very much. And actually, I'm sort of even now feeling a little bit nervous about talking about it, because you sort of don't want to analyse it too much, because then if you analyse it, you start to examine it. And if you examine it, you start to potentially take it apart. And if you take it apart, you're lost.
Yes.
So I guess that's...
I will not make you pull this apart, this beautiful thing.
Thank you.
No, I just want to... I mean, I just... my favourite break, because I was listening to it on the way in, is not because one of you said something like appalling or outrageous, of which there are thousands of amazing moments in the show where you are gasping and laughing on the bus and all the good stuff. But my favourite one is when Julia Davis just pronounces... you're talking about the sexy godson, who was obviously a recurring character. What I love is that you said all this and you're looking embarrassed while I'm just talking
I'm
about...
I'm not embarrassed. I'm not ashamed to say
no,
it.
No, do not be ashamed. He sounds like a fine young man. Mm. There's a sexy godson, recurring character, and it's you're talking about some photos that have been sent in of him, and Julia just goes, and there he is in the musical Grease.
So both,
and there's no laugh on mic. I can just feel you both stopping, and there's like a bubble in your throat of going, what's that musical again?
Oh, it's so ridiculous.
It's wonderful. I love
it. So, thank you
so much. And there is something just about just having a mic running and knowing you've got that freedom to edit that means you can...
Yeah, you can say what you want.
I'm not going to use words like brave and stuff like that, but is there... Are there bits when you, like, other people you wouldn't want to listen to it, or you're embarrassed if you find out they listen to it?
There's always a moment when somebody says, oh, I've heard your podcast, where you think, are they judging me differently, seeing me differently? Mm. And then I've had to kind of let go of that a little bit. It's when it's sort of mums of your sons.
Yes.
That say they've heard it, there's always a moment of, oh, okay. Do they think this is funny, or do they think this is inappropriate? For a woman of my age with a family, you know.
But it's so appropriate, because it's like there's always a trick of trying to talk about stuff that we really care about that no one else talks about. Things like sex and depression and those kind of things. And if you just did a big old TED talk where you and Julia sat there and talked very earnestly about these things, I'd love it. I imagine it would have a huge toll on you emotionally.
Maybe.
But to put it all in the character of your daughter Cardinal.
Yeah.
Or Julia talking about burying her, not sure what to do with her mum's funeral, or whether she should bury her or have her exploded, as this is the modern trend these days. You're talking about this stuff. Anyway, as you say, let's not pick it to pieces, because I would be devastated if you didn't do more. You've done some more.
We're about to launch a new series.
I'm so happy. Well, yeah, let's talk about... Let's go straight on to your choices, I think. Because I think what was brilliant about some of the stuff you chose, there seems to be a kind of theme across all of them. I don't know if you were aware.
No, good, tell me.
I like it when there's clearly a lot... Like, things are linked together. So we're probably going to fly all over the place with these a bit, I think, which is they're very visceral and they're very based in the body.
Okay.
And very... which I think a lot of Joan and Derrica is, obviously, and I think a lot of your sense of humour naturally is. But when you were writing Getting On, very medical-based.
Yes.
Did you do loads of research for that?
Oh, we did tons of research, and that was sort of terrifying for me, because as we'll come on to later, my sort of biggest fear is based around sort of medical testing and medical intervention, and it's something that's really quite deep-seated and which I really had to kind of work on, actually, to sort of just not disappearing down a plug hole. But both my parents worked in the NHS and my dad worked at Queen Mary's Hospital in Roehampton, and they had, I think a lot of this was, I used to go and see him at work, and he would take us down corridors to the canteen, me and my sister, Jane. And you would sort of see glimpses at very early age of quite scary things in wards and people hooked up to things.
Yeah.
So that was one thing. And then the second thing was that we were invited every year to the what was called at that point, because they called these things like this at that in that moment in time, the League of Pity Party. And the League of Pity Christmas, it was the League of Pity, and they had a Christmas party every year. And it was full of really ill children.
Oh,
and children with little bald heads undergoing chemo and, you know, really awful.
Oh, sorry, I'm nervous. I'm a nervous giggler.
No. I know you don't think it's funny. It's
no,
fine.
No, I'm laughing at the horror
of
that
name. It's pretty horrific. Yeah, sorry, yeah. But my mum particularly was very much, she was very sort of straightforward and didn't seem to be freaked by anything like that and kind of seemed to almost think it was just good schooling to be around people with quite severe disabilities. And of course, I actually agree with her now.
Yeah.
But I think the difficulty for me then was, I'm going to catch something, or I'm going to, children die, and that's really scary. And of course they do.
Mm.
Of course they do, and it is something that we need to be really aware of in this world. But at the same time, I think because it was sort of unstructured and there was no talking about it afterwards, it was just going in, sitting at a table with these kids and then getting a sort of very tiny plastic gift from a very peculiar looking Father Christmas in the corner and then going home. And so I sort of think a lot of it stems from that being somebody with a big imagination that then takes you into all sorts of worlds where you've sort of seen something and then you accept and build, which is, of course, a great thing for improvising, but quite a difficult thing for life.
Yes, the limit, the imagination.
Yeah.
My God.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, so I obviously before we record, I asked my guests to sort of send me what they think we might talk about, and you sent me this poem that you said this is a super creepy poem.
Yeah.
That my mum used to read me when I was a child, and I'd never come across this, and I was wondering, I've got it here, would you mind reading it for me?
Absolutely. We had this book and it was in there with a super creepy sort of, to my mind, picture accompanying it, and it goes like this: one misty moisty morning when cloudy was the weather, I chanced to meet an old man clothed all in leather. He began to compliment and I began to grin, how'd you do and how'd you do and how'd you do again?
I mean, there's a lot in there, isn't
there?
What
about that, guys? Little girls. Misty, moisty morning.
This might be where
cloudy weather. So it's not a lovely sunny day. You're not meeting a sort of cheery old chap in a cap on a sunny day, meeting a man dressed in leather.
A leather-clad man.
You can't see him properly. It's misty and moisty, and you don't know where that is.
He's very chatty.
He's chatty.
He's very Stranger Danger.
He's even complimenting what I thought was a young... I think it's a child in the picture, but in my child's mind, it's me he's
Of course. Yeah.
And complimenting. So, I like your dress. I like your little shoe. I like your legs. To me, it was kind of it kind of went to a really creepy place really quickly.
It's really creepy.
I think it is quite creepy. I don't think that's just me, is it?
No, absolutely not. Yeah. I mean, I'd never come across it. And I was like, is this something that Vicky's mum has remembered in her head?
Because
she's
drawn a picture
of an actual monster. And no, the worst, I Googled it. And I found
the pit?
So many versions of this.
Hey.
This, I think, is the creepiest one. This is on YouTube.
Oh,
and
yeah.
This is a program for preteens. Or not preteens. This is a program
pre-schoolers.
For preschoolers, like nursery children. I'm just going to play it a little bit.
Ooh.
Try again.
Oh, yeah, it's a girl.
Yeah, a little girl and an old a man with a curly
and
tash.
An
and
man.
It's such childlike, cartoony, cheap CGI.
Oh,
entirely for your little children
weird.
To enjoy and love.
Yeah,
and
so little girls, listen to old men.
Listen to old men who stop you and compliment you.
Yeah, and give them and grin. And give them a little smile.
That's it.
I began to grin.
Be compliant.
Be compliant, be happy. Just be basically predator heaven. I mean, come off it.
That's, I think,
you know,
that's,
and at that time we were sort of all watching Jimmy Savile very cheerfully on the television. I mean, it's just, you sort of do think, God, what was going on? I mean, I think that poem's a really old poem, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know when it was first written, but
I did a little bit of research and then I got frightened and stopped,
yeah,
which
no,
has
I'm
happened quite a lot on
really?
This, where I just
really?
Started digging around and it seems to go back one stage to being a poem from the mid 17th century that was actually about a wedding between like haywain or something. The reason he's wearing only leather because he's on his way to like cut some hay or something.
Right,
I don't know.
Okay.
I sort of was reading with one eye open, squinting.
Wow.
But it's about a sort of literally a maiden, and her dad gives her dowry, and they end up getting married at the end of it.
Yeah.
So it's really old fashioned. But yeah, she's not a tiny child as we think of it when we're talking about it. So it's like,
well,
so
it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think as a child, you think when it says he and I. The I becomes you, doesn't it?
Of course, yeah.
And so that for a child to have that read to them is, I think, a bit suspect, frankly.
Yeah.
But, obviously my mum had no idea, I don't suppose, that that's what I was feeling about it. Clearly we weren't a family that were good at talking about those sort of things, as nobody was, I don't think, in the 60s and 70s.
No.
It was kind of like, it wasn't fashionable, or it just wasn't a thing.
Yeah, I mean, the horrifying thing is it was a thing that was going on,
but no one talked about it. Exactly.
Yeah,
that. Yeah.
I mean, it's what's weird about all those fairy tales and stuff like that we just pass on and pass on and pass on. I think, when your kids were little, did you worry about reading them, you know, the horrible old versions of stuff or the patriarchal versions of stuff?
Well, I didn't really read them old stuff. I mean, I didn't consciously do it, but thinking about it, I didn't really. I mean, I think somebody gave us some Oscar Wilde poems or something.
Oh, wow.
And we looked at those. I mean, they were both boys, so in a funny way, maybe if it had been a girl, I would have been far more rigorous and vigilant, because I think that the fairy stories that girls are read are so deeply damaging, potentially, that I would have been, you know, quite policey of it.
Yes.
I remember one of my friends had a girl and she was the fashion police, so she would allow one pink dress every 4 years or something. But, you know, I mean, and actually that kind of paid off, because her daughters are just fantastic now and brilliant, independent-minded young women, and didn't go through the whole thing that a lot of girls get pushed through, I think.
Yeah. Old men in leather.
By old men in leather.
Yeah.
There they are. There they are.
But the whole waiting to be rescued thing.
Yeah.
It is, the original Little Mermaid story, which is actually really awesome, but it's sort of horrifying. Like, she's walking on blades on her feet and stuff like that. Really stories, but not for children.
Grim, in fact,
they
is
are
the word, isn't it?
Grim as hell. And there were all sorts of allegories for, you know, don't trust old women because they're crying. They were all sort of like meant to help you through life.
Old women, that's really interesting, isn't it?
It's people going, don't let women help other women give birth.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the sort of old school midwives, and they all got burnt as witches.
Yeah,
so
I know.
You were on a medical edition of Pointless.
Yes, I was.
I'm so jealous of anyone that's ever been on Pointless.
It was joyous. I mean, it's called Pointless Celebrities,
yeah,
which is obviously, you know, quite funny in itself. But I really enjoyed that. I was on with Ricky Grover, who played Hillary, the modern matron in Getting On, who is fantastic, but who did say to me beforehand, I don't know anything at all, so you're going to have to answer all the questions. So that was quite scary, but because he's very self-deprecating. He's hilarious, Ricky. I adore him. But anyway, so, that was super fun. And I got to meet, people off Holby and Casualty, I think, were also on. And then those brilliant, the people who actually won were the TV proper real doctors.
Right.
Dr. Raj.
Something for the mums on CBeebies.
What a lovely, lovely, lovely man that is. That is just a delightful person right there. And I think Dr. Hillary or whatever it is.
Oh, yes.
But also charming. But anyway, so...
Silver Fox.
Yeah, that was fun. That was fun.
Cool. When you do stuff like that, do you get nervous about... I've found some weird clips of you on... I've gone a bit deep on stalking you, but I love watching things like when you're on Sunday Brunch or Saturday Kitchen is one of those,
isn't Sunday
it?
Brunch.
Are you nervous about that kind of...
To Morris Dance. I always get nervous, but I always slightly enjoy them. And I have got a slight mad rule, which is again related back to the fear. Not my fear, but
you're so good at dragging this back on track.
I'm keeping it on topic. No, but I think it is. I think that this happens a lot. Is that it's very easy to say no to a request like that because you think, oh God, it'll be too terrifying. And then I slightly have this thing where I have to make myself say yes, because I watch shows, I watch panel shows, I watch, things like Sunday Brunch. You watch them and you think, oh, they're very good on that one. But a lot of shows where you don't see enough women and you sort of think, wait a minute, why aren't there any women on this? And then if you're a woman and you're asked and you want to say no, you really can't if you're me, because that's... you kind of go, oh, wait a minute, I'm turning down something that I would want to watch myself, so I have to do it.
Oh, that's so smart. Yeah, you address your fear by going, like, it's not about me.
No.
It's about someone else.
It's a sort of
that's
responsibility.
That's exactly how I deal with stuff.
I've got to step up, because even if I make an absolute idiot of myself, at least I've said yes, and then, I don't know, maybe it's less scary for someone else doing it.
My mate bought a toaster. We go through celebrities' Amazon purchase histories so you don't have to. Keep calm and love Dom Jolly novelty keyring and fridge
that.
Magnets.
Yeah, I love that.
The G-spot.
The good vibrations, guys.
Green dot laser sight rifle gun scope.
I've bought that quite a lot of times, I think.
Right, okay. The sex doctor's guide to keeping it hot.
Ah, interesting.
Did another child come along 9 months later?
Yeah.
Loads of great apps up now, and new ones dropping every Monday. That's My Mate Bought a Toaster from Great Big Al.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So we might move on to your film and TV choice.
Yeah.
You said that your a film that you saw when you were a teenager is, and the thing that has stayed with you, clearly, and again, I'm coming back to...
Bodies.
Yeah. Is the,
and midwives.
And midwives. Yes, well let's get on to it. It's the creature bursting out of John Hurt in Alien.
Oh, God.
Oh, God!
No, not
touch it! Don't touch it!
Oh, tell God. Me when.
Well, I went to see it with. I was trying to work out because I can't remember years, but I wasn't yet 20, I believe. Mm-hmm. I can't have been actually, and I went to see it with this great friend of mine, and I just could barely watch any of the movie. I think, again, part of that was about identifying, and in a brilliant way at this moment in time, identifying with Sigourney Weaver's kind of lead, brilliant lead role in that movie, and that being quite a new thing, actually, but therefore feeling more engaged, perhaps, than the other movies I might have seen where it's the man, and although we're all very used to watching the man and kind of going, yeah, I can feel like that man, when it actually is a woman, there's something different, a kind of different transaction that happens, I think, as a female watching it. And so I was much more in that movie, probably, than I might have been in another sci-fi scary movie for a start off. And then in that moment, that to me was a sort of horrific combination of lots of things I was frightened of, which were probably around... thinking about it, you know, this idea of a being coming from another being and the fear of birth, or, you know, the fear of producing, or the responsibility of that in some shape or form, but also just the super scary moment, the brilliant music, the way it's all builds to this explosive moment where this, what now when we watch it looks like a sort of funny little glove puppet, but at the time was... super at the forefront of technology in terms of how they filmed it and what they did and how they made it work, and the tricks they used to make that happen. But
well, it's a lovely combination of modern techniques, but also really ancient ones. Like, he's just underneath the table with his head poking through a hole, and they build a fake body around him, which is, you know, the oldest trick in the book, like the magician's trick. And they packed. They didn't tell anyone they were going. What was going to happen? It just says in the script a thing emerges from
him. Gosh.
So no one knew what was going to come. Gosh. All the actors were gathered. All the actors were sort of just told to sort of, you know, react how they wanted to react to get the proper scary look on their face, which they obviously do. And he's lying. So he's underneath the table. They've got a sort of scarecrow body on the thing, and then they packed him with genuinely like old bits of meat, like offal, real offal, so that the smell was right, that everything was, because it was the only way they could get it to look as real as they did. Is that just by how do you make something look like guts?
Put guts in.
Wow. And yeah, so everyone's facial expression is just like they're sort of disgusted by the smell. They're in. I mean, are you allowed to do that to actors now?
I don't know. Probably not.
Has anyone ever put you through that sort of thing? Imagine Julie Davis does sometimes.
Well, not fish guts. I'm trying to think. I don't think anything.
But they do like to spring things on actors, don't they, sometimes?
Yeah, although I haven't really heard. No, I think they tend to sort of explain everything and be very, very, very respectful actually now and say, what I'm going to do next is I'm going to put this on your face and I'm going to do this. I'm going to sit on your face. I don't know if there are maybe new rules that you have to abide by. So I suspect you wouldn't necessarily be able to do that now, but you probably could in some indie movie and everyone would be like, yeah, that was really cool because they didn't tell us. But I don't know.
The more we find out about how films get made, the more it's really hard to watch sort of basically anything.
The
whole Last Tango in Paris thing. Where she was genuinely, according to her, I have every right. She was genuinely assaulted because apparently you couldn't fake.
Yes.
You couldn't trust her to act everyone else in the room.
She
had to be assaulted for you to get that moment of. I mean, it's different. This is just sounds like what a fun day on set. Someone says something scary is going to happen to you and you're going to get frightened.
It is interesting though. But yes, I mean that was I think the most terrifying moment in my sort of cinema going history. Having said that, I've very studiously avoided going to horror movies for the most part, and I'm very feeble in watching things like that.
See, that fascinates me because obviously going back to all the dark places that you go to a lot in your performances and the work you choose to be in and your characters stuff. Yeah. You seem quite fearless to me.
I know, but it's funny, isn't it? I think it's more trying to push myself to do. As much as I can, but also a bit of self-protection, because I know that I'll retain images. So if I go and see too many horror movies, I'll retain that image really in my brain for a long, long time, and then it'll come in the night and I won't be able to sleep. Sad. Sad but true.
Yeah, I mean, I loved quite how. I mean, I guess do you ever with playing sort of some of the characters you play? I mean, how would you describe the sort of characters that you? Is there a word you use?
Well,
because I think the characters play very different, but they're all in their own
way.
There
is a sort of
dark and broken
theme, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, I think I don't know. I think what happens sometimes is when you see things with women over. Maybe even just 45 or even 40 or something, that usually... I remember a friend of mine who's an actress saying to me, I'm just really sick of being offered parts where somebody shouts at my character, you mad bitch.
Fun police.
And I thought, oh, yeah, no, that's really interesting. But I think what happens with me is that I get drawn to parts that are about people who you could sort of on the surface say, you mad bitch, but underneath it have a world of... reasons why you might be a mad bitch that go right back to kind of maybe back to what we were talking about, you know, little girls' fairy tales and what we're all made to think we should be and how disappointing potentially it might be when you're not the princess with the long blonde hair or whatever it is that, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I think that I really find it fascinating to look underneath characters and go, what's happening below that surface? And I always want to find something that, it's about vulnerability and human truth, as opposed. This sounds very pretentious, so apologise. But you know, so that people watching won't just go, "Look, there's another mad bitch."
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
No, that makes complete sense. I think you clearly have so much fun playing the kind of characters you play. Yeah. But I also think there's huge differences between Pippa in Getting On and I've forgotten the name of the character playing Camping. Sorry,
Fiona
thank you.
Camping. Yes, but there are similarities for sure.
There are similarities. Though. They're very blunt. They say things that are, you know.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
I think
yeah.
Pippa is sort of. she just has no humour.
No,
that's her biggest trait.
Yeah,
she's absolutely laser focused on this thing. She doesn't understand why poo's funny. She doesn't understand why vaginas are funny.
No,
getting your
not.
Teeth into my atrophied vagina.
Yeah, no, absolutely not.
Doesn't get it.
And that's the beauty of that playing that sort of character is that you get to say quite outrageous things, but you're allowed to because it's a world where those things are allowed to be said.
Yes. So getting back to the sort of the alien theme, because I wanted to come back to what you said earlier about how to do with sort of the fear of birth and things coming out of your bodies, which is so palpable in the Alien, possibly because of the female lead. But obviously these things don't happen to anyone. Ripley never experiences these things until the sequels. But the fact that it's sort of men's fear of having something invade them and leave their bodies. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah. I do think it's a sort of absolutely brilliant moment in cinematic history. It sort of was, I don't know, I mean, there must have been things bursting out of people before that, but there was something so incredible about that moment and so unexpected. Mm. I sort of thought it was brilliant and weirdly, looking back on it, sort of weirdly beautiful, but now... that's with very much hindsight. And at the time, I was just absolutely freaked. I kind of jumped out of my seat. Sort of brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah, God, it's amazing. Yeah. What's interesting about the character of Ripley as well is it was written for a man and then it was a very last-minute thing.
Well, God, isn't that so interesting? Because I think there is a new thing. I read somebody saying, maybe it was that woman in The Bridge... who said she just played the part as a man or something. Mm. Was it her who said she'd based her performance
Very
on
possibly.
John Wayne or something?
Oh, no, that was, Raised by Wolves, Rebecca Staton.
Oh, was that her?
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
But she's also Rebecca Staton said she played the mum character in the brilliant Raised by Wolves as she was channeling John Wayne. But I've seen that happen.
So I think that's the thing. And actually, I think more and more I think that we could reimagine stories because I think for a lot of people, it's very hard because a lot of the childhood stories were historically about boys doing things. And it was a sort of, it's boys, but it's everybody.
Yeah.
And all the girls had to go, oh, it's a boy, but it's me as well.
Yeah.
I'm the boy, but I'm not the boy. So it's very hard for me to feel at the centre of a story. Mm. And I think when people are writing quite often, their default setting is it's a man at the centre of the story. And we all want to kind of see the man's story because that feels more exciting or... I don't know, it's what we're used to or something. But I think this idea of, which I think people like Gina Davis and, you know, all those brilliant... Hollywood actresses who've stood up and gone, you know, things need to be different, have started to say, you know, you could just put a woman in that same role and it would be a great story. It's still a great story.
Yeah, and the idea that you do a straight gender swap and suddenly women are swashbuckling and sassy and have no vulnerabilities and stuff is sort of the other way things are going.
Yeah,
and actually what you can do with a female character is do something a bit more interesting.
Maybe real, where we are swashbuckling, but we're also fighting demons and kind of our own demons and our own insecurities and our own fears and kind of, you know, having to really push ourselves to kind of be the centre. And it's an uncomfortable place to push yourself to, I think, as well.
Well, I think that's again, going back to Joan and Jerrica, it's the idea of finding ways to talk about stuff without... through the characters rather than sort of doing a straight-to-camera, here's my experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing is with something like... with Joan and Jerrica in particular, there was never an agenda to set out to do that thing.
Yeah.
And I think if you set out to do that thing, you might not have so much joy in achieving it. Mm-hmm. But if you set out to do your thing, whoever you are and whatever you're doing... particularly for women, that then you kind of can't go wrong.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Well, let's talk about a fear you live with now, because I think it's sort of folded into what we've been talking about anyway, which is you said medical testing, but generally any medical stuff, GPs, hospitals and any ambulances going so odd that I wrote three series of Getting On with Joe Brand and John Scanlon. Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
So this is still a recent thing, even after all that catharsis of writing that amazing show.
Oh, yeah, for sure. No, I mean, I have a massive... world of anxiety around doctors, any doctors actually. If I have to go, sometimes when you do a TV thing, you have to go for a medical. Wow. And all they do is take your blood pressure. I mean, it's very sort of, I don't know, it's sort of for insurance stuff, I think. Yeah. They kind of ask you when you last had your latest health checkup, and they take your blood pressure and they ask you a few questions. And usually that's it, unless you've got something particular that you've got to kind of tell them about. But on the whole, it's pretty straightforward and very brief. But every time I have to go for one of those, I have sort of palpitations, basically. Really? And as they approach me with the blood pressure, and I don't think I've ever had high blood pressure, because I think I've actually got quite low blood pressure. So when I go to have my blood pressure checked, it ramps up
and actually normalizes.
My heart's slightly speeding up telling you about it.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
So as they approach,
I'm so sorry.
I'm going to need a gin and tonic. They approach with the kind of puffy thing that they put on your arm, I start to feel anxious. Oh. And I don't know quite, I mean, I've got some theories, but I sort of feel like it's inevitable. There's an inevitability in my mind that when they look, they will find something wrong. There is something wrong inside me that they will find, and that it's just a question of time before that happens. Now, of course, the reality is that that's true, that as you get older and then you get ill and then you die, that's something that I think I've really struggled to accommodate. And I think in recent years, maybe I hope I'm moving a bit more to this kind of understanding that I am not immortal and that I will become ill and I will die. But even now, saying that, I think, yeah, but I still don't want to go through any medical testing. It's too scary.
Oh, that's a lot. Oh, my goodness.
It's. I mean, I don't know. I think a lot of people share the basis of this anxiety, of course, because it's a human anxiety.
Yes.
But I'm not sure everyone shares this certainty that, you know, it's only a question of pricking the surface and you'll find some terrible thing.
Well, it's in order to do your job, you have to go through this as well. So there's no choice in there.
Yeah.
In order to do your job, you have to put yourself through this quite invasive thing.
I think you do. You have to sort of poke around, for want of a better description, and dig about for things and haul them out.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know. I think that the writing is really a saviour in many ways, because instead of having to sit with it and process it, or, you know, go to other people to try and process it, which I have done in the past, actually, but which I don't do currently, but where you can go, I don't have to sit with this within me all the time, because I can put it out onto my piece of paper and then it lives alongside me instead of inside me, which is actually incredibly helpful. And I think for anybody going through any difficult process, just writing things down, even if you're not a writer, or you might become a writer by doing it, that actually it frees up. It's something about the mechanics of letting it out that is helpful.
That's fantastic.
It can be, and it sounds ridiculously pretentious again, but it can be a painful process. But actually, once it's done, you know, once you've got that bit out, you've got that bit out. And that's not to say there's not another bit backing it up and waiting to sort of stalk you in the night. But at the same time, I think it lets out the pressure a bit.
God, that's really interesting. Mm. And do you find it hard to get starting writing? Like, do you feel under pressure to A, write funny things, which I'm, you know, is your chosen genre?
Yeah.
And do you find it hard to sort of get started and think of?
I tend to have an idea and then I tend to talk it over a little bit with people and sometimes do a bit of improvising with people and sort of just trying to unlock some of the more, where it can expand to. But the sitting down and doing it, I find really hard.
Mm.
Again, I mean, going back to what I said at the beginning, if you can go away and be outside your usual world, I think it's easier.
Yeah.
And
I've been quite fascinated recently by conversations I've been having with lots of male comedy writers friends. And we're all sort of seethingly jealous of photos that we've come across of Monty Python all going off to Jamaica to go and write Life of Brian together. And we've been finding all these photos of like men in shorts and cigarettes and pipes on their typewriters and you know, how Douglas Adams would go off and write Hitchhikers in like Corfu or something. And I just said, oh, God, I love that. Are we allowed to do that?
I think we are. I mean, I think it's expensive. You've got to get someone to pay for you to do it. But if you're lucky enough to have that access, then absolutely. Mm. And I think that's the other thing about, I mean, I, you know, you know, as a woman, you kind of, there's a bit of you that thinks, I can't leave my child. And that's a really, really strong one.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a really difficult one for women, because I also completely understand that. Mm. And I, now my children are so much older, I sort of feel like they can't wait to get rid of me. And actually, I think that, you know, they I literally sometimes say to them, do you mind if I go? And they go, I don't really care, Mum, in the nicest possible way.
Yeah.
That's incredibly freeing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I realised the other day, that I haven't read A Room of One's Own because I haven't had time.
Oh,
but
great.
When you were saying
I think that's quite good.
I think,
but yeah,
you literally don't have time to read the book about how women need to find time and space to go and create.
Oh no,
the
definitely,
artist.
Definitely have a read. I think it's well worth it.
Yeah,
but yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it is a thing, isn't it? The pram in the hall, you know, the kind of.
This is a great kick up the arse, the pram in the hallway, because you suddenly.
I think there is a level of that.
You suddenly get a bit superhuman about time management.
You get bloody focused. Yeah. You're like, I've got an hour now whilst that little thing's asleep.
Yeah.
And, you know, please don't wake up before that hour, but my God, I'm going to use that hour.
Amazing. I'm just trying to think if there's anything else I want to talk about.
Sure.
Oh actually, yes, sorry, to go back, because you were talking about how you like to improvise when you're coming up with new ideas and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I read an interview, so correct me if the interview was that you went to drama school quite late, like,
yeah, I did.
27.
Yeah.
That really interests me. Can you tell me a bit more?
Oh, well, that was really, again, I mean, it sounds like I'm trying to fold everything into your podcast. Honestly, truly.
Everything links back to being scared all the time.
It does, you know. So I, at school, I was very drawn to doing drama-y kind of stuff, and I was quite musical. But I didn't know that anybody could be on the television. I thought that the television was reserved for a very particular species of being. Because at that time, there wasn't the sort of, there wasn't Big Brother, there wasn't, you know, there was nobody who wasn't a kind of other sort of being that was on the telly, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So everybody was special, basically, is what I'm saying, who got onto the telly. And I knew I wasn't special. I was from, you know, my mum and dad worked in the health service. We were a kind of pretty ordinary family in many ways. Me and my sister, you know, we went to university, but we were, I think, the first in our family to go to university, in our broad family. And so it was something that never felt like it was something I could do. And then when I was at university, I went to UEA and did history of art. And because I was always very interested in paintings and, you know, visual stuff as well. And there I was fortunate enough to have two lecturers, one of whom was a Marxist and the other of whom was a Marxist feminist. And through their kind of, you know, why don't you read this book about how we look at things? And why don't you look at this paper about how we view the female gaze and the male gaze? And, you know, all of those sort of things that began to open some doors for me and make me understand, oh, that's why I never got asked to dance at discos. You know, I get it now. Yeah. I understand now why the Misty Moisty Morning poem was, I should have taken on board and really sort of done those things and grinned a bit more instead of standing in the corner thinking nobody fancies me and I must be ugly. You know, there was a kind of weird misprocess, I think, that happened to me as a girl, which I'm very happy about, but which led to this kind of feeling a bit different. Anyway, went to university, did some kind of cabaret type stuff, but again, really didn't think a person like me could possibly be an actor. And then I did various jobs and was quite unhappy doing those jobs. And then I got to the end of one particular job and I thought, well, actually, interestingly, it was around the time I was dumped by a boyfriend, and I thought, God, I've got to get out of London. Not out of London, but I've got to get out of my rut.
Yeah.
Got to get out. Mm-hmm. And so I went to East 15 Drama School because Alison Steadman was my hero.
Fantastic. And back to the Rainforest Machete.
Absolutely. What a genius one. But Abigail's Party.
Yeah.
You know, totally trailblazing type.
God.
Brilliant, brilliant woman. And she was really the reason I selected East 15, and they accepted me onto a one-year postgrad course.
Yeah.
And then that was that, really. And then when I came out of East 15, I looked at parts, and I wasn't any of those parts either. I wasn't the young ingenue. I was actually too old already.
Right.
Plus, I'd never been like that anyway and never fitted those roles. And then there was the sort of leap, and then there was the horrid mother-in-law, and there wasn't much in between, actually. And I was sort of forced into writing
because...
there weren't really that many jobs for me. I mean, I played some prostitutes. Don't get me wrong, and some maids actually. So you know, it was quite a glittering start.
Which one's more fun to play, a prostitute or a maid?
Oh, I think a prostitute. Yeah, sure.
You'd think Yeah.
It was in the Threepenny Opera, so, and that's quite good. So it was quite fun. But you know, I did think. I can't see the parts for me, so I'm going to have to make my own work, really.
That's fantastic.
And then with the comedy side of things, I mean, I did find occasionally now I get serious parts, but it's very rare. And I think for the most part, if I read a script out loud, I accidentally make it funny. Mm. So even if it's a really deep drama, I sort of, I don't know, something happens where I don't know why that happens, but it sort of just does.
Well, yeah.
And some dramas now, they allow that in, so it's not such a terrible thing. But I think, you know, maybe 10 or 20 years ago, if you were funny in a drama, that was absolutely unacceptable.
Yeah, the lines got very blurred recently.
Yeah, it's got quite blurred. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, no, it's good. I think, you know, I'm thinking about Getting On in particular. It's like nothing, your character would never, ever crack a joke. Your character's never said anything intentionally funny in a whole life.
Yeah.
So you have to play that.
Yeah.
Incredibly straight.
Yeah,
incredibly
exactly.
Drama.
And I think straight can be the funniest thing.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I think
that's
often the case. And, you know, gags, I think writing gags is a big skill and some people have it. I don't know whether I have it or not, really, but I think it's something you have to really work at. And I think, again, maybe men are more encouraged to write gags than women. I don't know.
You know, people always say, oh, gag jokes are really hard. And I think they're not. What's really hard is having the bravery to not have the joke there and have the moment breathe.
Well,
and
except
then,
we love jokes, you know, jokes are great, and we love to laugh.
Yeah.
And I think laughing, again, in that is another kind of fantastic, fantastic sort of freeing thing to be able to do.
Yeah. I'm going to just circle back to this, because
sure.
I meant to talk to you about
when
we were talking about Alien and bodies and all that kind of. Would you say we're talking about sort of relationship with our bodies and stuff, and obviously the stuff you write has lots of physical
bodily
stuff. Do you think your relationship with your body has changed over
the years? Well, I was thinking about that. I was walking here, funnily enough. I was thinking about how did it come about. I was thinking about exactly that on the way here, because obviously I was very conscious that the material I'd sent to you all comes back, as you've rightly sort of pointed out, to this kind of potential body phobia, almost this kind of fear of what I'm living in, and I think, as I said at the beginning, that's born of this. It's born of the dangers I've seen, visceral dangers of people being ill and dying that I saw at quite an early age. Although, I'm not saying I was in a war zone, and obviously that's, I'm not saying poor me. I'm just saying that may have contributed
I'd say
to
you
it.
Definitely saw more dying children than most probably children ever see.
Probably true. Yeah. Well, I'd hope.
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
But actually thinking about my relationship to my body and the sort of, I was talking to somebody recently where they said, they just got their period and they were really shocked by it. And she said, I realised that every month I get my period, I'm shocked. And I thought, that's interesting, because I think that's how I felt, was every time I saw blood, I felt a sense of shock. That it never was like, oh yeah, it's my period. Right. It was sort of like, oh. And I don't know where that quite comes from, but I think, again, it might be about my family's lack of kind of, it's all okay and cool to bleed. It's actually a bit repressed, and it's a bit like, oh, don't let your father see that you've got a tampon in your bag, or and a bit of an element of that, really.
Yeah.
And him being a very, very private, very shy man, and him being sort of slightly freaked by female body stuff, if I'm really honest.
That's really interesting for a doctor, yeah.
He wasn't a doctor, actually. He worked in the NHS.
Mm.
But, he was an absolutely darling person and a big, lovely, lovely, lovely man. But I think he had a lot of anxieties around body. And actually, and here's another bit of all of this, which I should have probably said right at the beginning, which only just occurred to me, was that he had lost a leg in the Second World War. So again, here was this proof that bodies get broken with this man with one leg, and his hiding of that. To a great extent, he was shy of it. He didn't ever go publicly swimming, or he was always a bit sort of nervous about displaying that leg. He should have been really proud, because he was kind of quite heroic in his loss of his leg, and he had a medal. But I think that seeing that meant to me bodies get broken and they don't get mended. And so that's a big aspect of it, I think. But also the female aspect of,
yes,
the, of the reproductive process and that. I'm not entirely sure, really, but I think it is born of fear of what that body is, mm-hmm. and not having a sense of fitting that body to a certain extent.
Yes.
Not feeling immensely female in the way that I think I felt I was meant to feel, and so it being a bit alien.
Yeah.
just drawing it all together. But also thinking about the menopause, which I've now been through, and thinking, God, it's so weird now to not bleed every month.
Yeah.
And thinking how, God, women go on this extraordinary journey in their lives where they begin with, they have all their little eggs but nobody knows, and then they start to bleed, and they kind of, hopefully there's a celebratory aspect to it, which I know that some people find great, but you know, certainly in my era it was sort of like a bit shameful and embarrassing, and nobody talked about it. And then you had people like Jo Brand making jokes about periods, and then it was okay to talk about periods, and then, you know, and then go on to be reproductive and have my two beautiful boys, and how, you know, deeply grateful I am to have them, and I'm just so happy that happened for me, because I kind of felt I wouldn't be a mother for some strange reason. But anyway, and then now to have come through the other side and be non-fertile, but to be enjoying a new sense of creativity that's totally about me and not about making other life, which I'm finding very good fun.
Yeah, I mean, your body is yours.
And now I don't. And now, you know, somebody said the other day, have you got a tampon? I thought, no, I haven't got a tampon. I haven't got one anywhere. I mean, maybe I should carry them for my female beings. But I thought, God, no, I don't have a tampon. I don't own any tampons.
Oh, my God.
I may never own another tampon.
It's so funny. I mean, I have a confession. I never really went through the whole period thing. I went on the pill I started my periods when I was 15. I went on the pill when I was 16.
Wow.
I had periods, but it was the pill, and it wasn't a big deal. And then I had a kid.
And you knew when it would come.
And I knew exactly when it would come. Yeah. And I knew, well, now we know, because apparently you didn't have to take that break at all. They just put that in for God-fearing reasons, so that we all knew and felt shame and dirty.
Oh,
I mean, apparently it all came down from the Pope. Isn't that terrible? Kids just run on the packet.
Seriously, and don't bleed.
And don't bleed at all, because you don't have to.
But it was literally that song?
There's a song.
Only women bleed.
Well, exactly. I had a coil after I had a baby, and I haven't had one since.
Mate,
I don't have
blood free.
I am
corset free.
I've missed this vital part of womanhood.
You're not a real woman.
I'm not a real woman.
Oh my lord.
Yeah, and my trans sisters. We've got.
That's fascinating to me. So maybe we don't have to bleed, and that in itself is incredible.
Well,
I'm amazed.
All our kids, they probably won't ever have to. And isn't that, like, as if, but we sort of, it's like, you know, don't go through it, then you're not a proper lady.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
They're going to have, I mean, they have a choice to, and obviously some women can't take things and can't have coils and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
but it's, I think there's just this whole thing. It's like, it turns out that wasn't the thing that defined us.
Wow.
Our bodies and our cramps. There's much more to us than that.
That's really fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow.
God. Well, on that bombshell. I'm going to have to leave that in now.
Oh, God.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Not a real woman.
I'm going to get letters in.
You have
to bleed.
How dare you?
No, I think that's very cool.
Oh, man. Thank you so much for talking about all this stuff. And I think we'll listen to Joan and Jerrica, because it's amazing. And Vicky, thank you so much.
Our pleasure.
Cheers, everyone. Bye.
Up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.